Israel's government is facing calls for a ceasefire from some of its closest European allies.
I think the majority of the Israeli public is still supporting the war.
Plus, a ballistic missile fired by Yemen's Houthi rebels slammed into a cargo ship in the Red Sea following an earlier attack that struck a separate vessel.
The missile attack on the MSC Palladium 3 and the earlier assault on the Al Jazeera escalate a maritime campaign.
And political tensions have spiked in the Balkan country of Serbia over the parliamentary and local elections on Sunday. Today is Tuesday, December 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Kim Lewis. The U.S. and Israel are discussing ways to scale back major combat operations in the Gaza Strip. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
There are growing calls for a ceasefire, which the U.S. has rejected. Still, it's urging a shift to more targeted operations in Gaza, which Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin says was part of his talks in Tel Aviv with Israeli counterpart Yoav Gallant.
How to reduce harm to civilians in the battle space.
While the U.S. is worried about the high number of civilian deaths in Gaza, Austin specifies this is Israel's operation.
And I'm not here to dictate timelines.
Gallant says there are none.
No clock. That is running.
Saying Israel must achieve certain things before moving on to the next phase.
We will find the proper time to do so.
Gallant said last week major combat operations will last several more months. Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin confirmed America's support for Israel on Monday during a news briefing alongside Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant in Tel Aviv. Secretary Austin said the U.S. will not tell Israel how to run its war.
This is Israel's operation. And I'm not here to dictate timelines or terms.
Gallant said his country is fighting a brutal enemy while trying to protect civilians.
Secretary Austin, we both know the complexities of war. We both fought brutal terrorist organizations. We know that it takes time. Unlike our enemies, we are defending our values and we operate according to international law. The IDF is operating to minimize the harm to civilian population.
Israel's government is facing calls for a ceasefire from some of its closest European allies. There is also mounting outrage inside Israel after it emerged that the country's military mistakenly killed three hostages and two women taking refuge in a Catholic church in Gaza after an Israeli military attack. In addition, Human Rights Watch accuses Israel of intentionally starving Gaza's population, a claim Tel Aviv denies. My colleague Rick Pantaleo spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about these and other developments in the Israel-Hamas war.
I think the majority of the Israeli public is still supporting the war. There's a sense among Israelis that Hamas crossed a line on October 7th and that they simply cannot live with a situation in which Hamas retains any military power. That said, the killing of the three hostages has really shaken everybody up. The funerals were yesterday and today, and it was just heart-wrenching. You know, people who had survived more than 70 days in captivity and then to be shot by Israeli soldiers, even though they were waving a white flag, has really kind of shaken people up. At the same time, there is growing criticism, as you said, from the international community of Israeli actions in Gaza. Now, Israel is somewhat sensitive to that, although the criticism that they're the most sensitive to, of course, is from the United States. The Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, is here today, his second visit since October 7th. And at least publicly, he said, you know, the United States stands behind Israel. There's no timetable for ending this operation. Privately, there is kind of growing American pressure on Israel to end at least this phase of the operation in the next month or so. So Israel is sensitive to the international criticism, but really more to what the United States has to say.
Linda, at this point, are there even talks or negotiations going on about a ceasefire?
Well, Well, yes, because there are negotiations going on about a possible a second hostage deal. If you remember, in November, over a week, Hamas released more than 100 hostages in groups, and Israel released Palestinian prisoners. Now Hamas says it will only consider releasing more hostages if Israel agrees to a complete ceasefire, not just a pause the way it happened last time. So there are talks going on, but they're still at the preliminary stages. The Israeli head of the Mossad is meeting with people from Qatar, apparently in Warsaw, but it's still pretty far from it. And I think, you know, at least the polls show most Israelis do not want a ceasefire at this point. The toll is also rising for Israeli soldiers. The fighting in Gaza is very intense, and every day several Israeli soldiers are being killed in Gaza. The toll is now up to, I think, 127.
Something I've been curious about since this began, especially now, what is the relationship between the Palestinian people in Gaza, the civilians, and Hamas? How do they feel about each other?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Hamas has been controlling Gaza since 2007, and we've heard about a possibility that Hamas might be stealing some of the international humanitarian aid that's coming in. There was video released yesterday of gunmen sitting on top of the trucks, you know, with their faces covered. At the same time, Palestinians are hesitant to criticize Hamas publicly. They're scared. Anybody who criticizes Hamas, even on social media, gets a visit from Hamas telling them to stop doing it. So I know that when I've been interviewing people in Gaza, even people who I've known for quite a long time, they are very hesitant to say anything openly against Hamas. That said, I think there's growing frustration with Hamas and a growing feeling that Hamas has just made the situation worse than it's ever been. And Gaza really is on the verge of a real humanitarian disaster.
That was Rick Pantaleo speaking with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. A ballistic missile fired by Yemen's Houthi rebels slammed into a cargo ship in the Red Sea, which followed another attack only hours earlier that struck a separate vessel. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The missile attack on the MSC Palatium 3 and the earlier assault on the Al Jazeera escalate a maritime campaign by the Iranian-backed Houthis. John Storpert with the International Chamber of Shipping says cargo vessels will, however, still take the vital route that's been under attack.
There is an unease in the shipping industry because of these attacks and because of the increase in the scope of targets in recent days.
Storpert's hoping for a more robust naval presence in the Red Sea's strategic Bab el-Mandeb Strait.
What would help enormously would be reassurances from militaries in the region.
The attacks also endanger ships travelling through a vital corridor for cargo and energy shipments for both Europe and Asia from the Suez Canal out to the Indian Ocean. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
We're following these other stories from around the world. North Korea fired an ICBM-class missile Monday with a range capable of reaching anywhere in the United States, a Japanese official said, marking its second missile launch in hours. One of America's oldest and most iconic companies, United States Steel Corporation, agreed Monday to be sold to Japan's largest steel company, Nippon Steel Corporation, or NSC. U.S. Steel has been on the auction block since August, and this all-cash deal from Nippon is the highest bid at $14.1 billion. The death toll from a blast at an oil terminal in Guinea's capital Conakry on Monday has risen to 13, a senior police source said, as the government warned the incident could have repercussions for the wider population. The explosion at the West African nation's main oil terminal rocked the Kaloum Administrative District in downtown Conakry early in the morning. At least 111 people were killed and more than 230 injured after an earthquake hit the Gansu-Qinghai border region in China on Tuesday, according to reports by state media. The European Mediterranean Seismological Center had pegged the earthquake at magnitude 6.1. Chinese state media said the quake was registered at 6.2 magnitude. Political tensions have spiked in the Balkan country of Serbia over the parliamentary and local elections on Sunday. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has more.
Opponents of Serbia's President Aleksandar Vučić took to the streets of Belgrade, claiming Sunday's snap elections were rigged, as international observers said on Monday the vote was held in unjust conditions with multiple reports of irregularities. Among the protesters was Danica Samardžić, a student from Belgrade. She says, "This is one great shame on our people. We have been robbed. I am a student. I wish I could wake up tomorrow and live in peace. We want something to be done about all the problems we have in our country." The election put Vučić's SNS against Serbia Against Violence Opposition Alliance, or SPN. Vučić's party won nearly 47% of the ballots in the parliamentary vote, followed by Serbia Against Violence with 23%, according to a near-complete preliminary tally by the State Election Commission. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has won a third term with nearly 90% of votes in an election most Egyptians felt was a foregone conclusion. The former general's previous two terms were marked by a crackdown on political dissent. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder has more.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has won a third term in an election where he faced no serious challenges and garnered nearly 90% of votes, according to election authorities on Monday. Sisi called the result a rejection of the inhumane war in neighboring Gaza. Some voters said the eruption of conflict in Gaza had encouraged them to vote for Sisi, who presents himself as a bulwark of stability in a volatile region. That argument has also proved persuasive to Gulf and Western allies, who provide financial support to his government. Egyptians voted on December 10th to 12th. The state and tightly controlled domestic media pushed hard to boost turnout in the poll, which the election authority said had reached 66.8%, above the 41% recorded at the last presidential election in 2018. The election featured three other candidates, none of them high profile. The most prominent potential challenger halted his run in October, saying officials and thugs had targeted his supporters, accusations dismissed by the election authority. Many people in the Arab world's most populous country expressed indifference about the election, saying the result was a foregone conclusion. Reuters reporters witnessed voters being bussed into some polling stations and bags of food being handed out, while some voters said they were offered financial incentives. The state media body said any provision of money or goods in return for votes was a criminal offence. Sisi, a former general, has overseen a sweeping crackdown on dissent across the political spectrum since he led the overthrow of Egypt's first democratically elected leader, Mohamed Morsi of the Egyptian Brotherhood, in 2013.
Pope Francis formally approved allowing priests to bless same-sex couples. The Vatican issued a new document explaining a radical change in Vatican policy by insisting that people seeking God's love and mercy shouldn't be subject to an exhaustive moral analysis to receive it. The document from the Vatican's Doctrine Office was released Monday. AP correspondent Nicole Winfield reports doctrinally, it would be impossible for the church to allow for same-sex marriage.
This is merely a document that says if there are gay Catholics who are in a loving, stable union, a priest can offer a non-liturgical blessing to these people if they are seeking God's love and mercy. It has to be done outside of any context in which it would even give a hint of being like a marriage. It shouldn't be done at the same time as a civil union being registered legally. You're not even supposed to wear the types of clothes that could make it seem like it's a wedding.
That was AP correspondent Nicole Winfield. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. The U.S. Congress is running out of time to pass a new aid package for Ukraine as Senate lawmakers worked through the weekend to negotiate a deal for border security funding in return for Republican votes. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine approaches the two-year mark, Ukrainian soldiers say they remain fiercely determined to win. However, as winter is approaching, they are concerned that Russia is better equipped for battle and are frustrated over being on the defensive again in a war that is dragging on. I spoke with William Pomerantz, director of the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, about what Ukraine may be facing in the months ahead.
Well, I think Ukraine clearly is suffering from some elements of the fatigue, and probably they're suffering from the sense that the Western allies are not actually supporting Ukraine as much as they want, most notably the United States. They have gotten some very important successes in the past 2 years in terms of taking back Kharkiv, in terms of opening up the Black Sea and so forth. So the question is, what is the manpower for Ukraine going forward? The troops have basically been 2 years in battle without rotation. And so there is a question as to how long the Ukrainian troops can last. That is also the same situation for the Russian troops, because they also have been depleted and they have not been able to reinforce their troops as much as they would like. So both sides are facing the long winter, as it were, and neither side, I would say, is basically going into the winter in a strong position. And so obviously much will depend on U.S. support and whether Congress decides to give Ukraine additional support, or whether Ukraine simply potentially might just be abandoned. And then we will have to find out what is the consequence of the abandonment of Ukraine.
And certainly that is a big concern for Ukraine, especially looking at, as you mentioned, the U.S. and with some wavering financial support there with Congress, with a large focus on the Israel-Hamas war as well. So what can Ukraine look forward to in the months ahead?
Well, either Congress will make a deal and Ukraine will get the aid that it needs, or Congress will not make a deal and our ability to aid Ukraine in this hour of need will be greatly diminished. So I think we're racing towards a real final factor, as it were, in this war. And the question is whether the U.S. will continue to support Ukraine to the extent that it can actually field troops in battle. The EU has also decided that it's going to try to increase its support for Ukraine, but really the major actor for support and military support is the United States. So we are just facing a reckoning, and it might just be 2 weeks from now when the U.S. decides not to support Ukraine with more military assistance.
That was William Pomerantz, director of the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year hit Europe like a boulder thrown into a pond, creating large waves of Ukrainian refugees rippling across nations. Like a good neighbor, the tiny nation of Moldova answered Ukraine's calls for help. But UNHCR, the UN refugee agency, warned Friday countries like Moldova and Poland may be forced to cut essential activities without drastically increasing funding. VOA's Carla Babb reports from the Moldovan capital, Kinesau.
4 years and a half, Vera Rushkovskaya's family has been split apart. The three sisters, Vera, Nadia, and Lubov, faith, hope, and love in Ukrainian, fled the country with their daughters, nieces, and grandchildren, while their brothers and sons stayed home in Odessa. They are living in what was once a school for kids with autism in the Moldovan capital, Chisinau. Vera says the outpouring of support has been overwhelming and has literally saved her life. I was at the hospital with double pneumonia, she says. Everything was for free. I didn't pay a penny. I even wanted to give them chocolate, she says, but the nurses refused. Her granddaughter Amina says she's happy. And her daughter Marina says she sees other Ukrainian faces on occasion. But they say they miss home. It's very painful, she says. I lived in Ukraine for so many years, I didn't work anymore, so I only had to live, she says. And now at my age, I must flee. But we're lucky that people welcomed us so warmly here, she adds.
We've met very nice people here, like relatives. Like the Ryshkovskaya family, more than 1.5 million Ukrainians sought refuge from the war in neighboring Moldova.
This is just a small portion of the refugees.
And they just kept coming and coming.
Yes, coming and coming.
Interior Minister Adrian Efros was running Moldova's Crisis Management Center in February 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine.
When the war started, nobody was prepared to face this big influx of refugees. And it was not just a problem to let them in, but what to do with them next. They need a shelter, they need food, they need accommodation, and so on.
While the number of refugees entering Moldova has slowed since the war began, Efros says about 100,000 Ukrainian refugees still live in the country. That's nearly 5% of Moldova's total population.
So the demand is still very high, and we have this pendular movement of refugees to European countries and back.
Dozens of refugee centers popped up across Moldova as one of Europe's poorest nations absorbed what remains the continent's largest Ukrainian refugee population per capita. Carla Babb, VOA News, Chișinău, Moldova.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Kim Lewis.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Wanted by the Hong Kong police, pro-democracy activists living abroad, and the authorities are willing to pay handsomely for information leading to each activist's arrest. On December 14th, Hong Kong police added 5 more names to its list of individuals now living abroad who are wanted for violating Hong Kong's draconian national security law. The law was imposed on Hong Kong by the People's Republic of China in 2020 following large pro-democracy demonstrations protesting the loss of the freedoms and the autonomy Hong Kong had been promised would continue after Britain handed over the rule of the city to the PRC in 1997. Hong Kong authorities responded to the pro-democracy demonstrations with a massive crackdown. Since 2020, hundreds of people, including opposition politicians, civil society activists, journalists, and others, have been arrested under the national security law for their peaceful political activity and the exercise of their fundamental human rights. Many others have been forced into self-imposed exile. In July 2023, Hong Kong authorities announced that 8 pro-democracy activists living abroad would be pursued for life and a bounty would be offered for information leading to each one's arrest. Now Hong Kong has added 5 more names to the list: Simon Cheng, Johnny Falk, Tony Choi, and Joey Tsu, who is a U.S. citizen. Hong Kong police say these individuals are guilty of the crimes of colluding with foreign forces and incitement to secession. The bounty for each is 1 million Hong Kong dollars, the equivalent of $128,000 in U.S. funds. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller strongly condemned the egregious action taken by the Hong Kong authorities.
that shows blatant disregard for international norms, for democracy and human rights. We deplore any attempt to apply the Beijing-imposed national security law extraterritorially and reiterate that Hong Kong authorities have no jurisdiction within United States borders, where the advocates for democracy and freedom will continue to enjoy their constitutionally guaranteed freedoms and rights.
We remain committed to defending the rights and freedoms of our citizens, declared spokesperson Miller, and call on the PRC to act in accordance with its international commitments and legal obligations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.